Lecture 15, Lords of the Labyrinth.
In the last lecture, I mentioned how Flinders Petrie trained and influenced generations of young archaeologists. This lecture, too, is about the life of a single archaeologist who made a remarkable discovery. Another Englishman, Arthur Evans, son of the distinguished John Evans, an antiquarian who was responsible for the discovery of the antiquity of humankind. He discovered, almost single-handedly, the palace of Minos at Knossos and the Minoan civilization, starting in the year 1900. So with this lecture, we are embarking into a new century, into the century when archaeology became a truly multidisciplinary scientific discipline. It came of age, from a treasure hunt to a science. First, we're going to describe how the minute-sighted Arthur Evans studied small seals from Crete, which he found in the flea market in Athens, and then tracked down Minoan civilization on Crete. He started digging there in 1900 and worked there for over 30 years. The second part of the lecture describes the excavations, his attempts to reconstruct the palace, and his abortive efforts to decipher Minoan script. Finally, we describe Evans's rather romantic view of Minoan civilization as a carefree, peaceful society. We then assess how perceptions of Minoan civilization have changed since Evans's day. As I told you also last time, at the time of his death in 1890, Heinrich Schliemann had his eyes on Crete, where he knew from his Homer the legendary King Minos had once ruled, where his black-hulled ships, as Homer called them, traded the length and breadth of the known world. As always, Schliemann was following his beloved Homer, but he was unable to gain permission to dig at Knossos on the north coast, which was said to be the site of Minos's legendary palace. A decade passed before a quite different character, British archaeologist Arthur Evans, unearthed Minoan civilization. Arthur Evans was born in 1851. He was born into a cultured, prosperous family headed by the legendary John Evans, in later life Sir John Evans, who was not only a prominent papermaker and the epitome of the Victorian Renaissance scientist, but a charming gentleman as well. He was an internationally known geologist and collector. He collected fine art and also was celebrated as a prehistoric archaeologist. He was an expert on metal tools and on stone implements. It was he, together with geologist Joseph Prestwich, who in 1859 visited excavations in the Somme Valley in France, where crude stone axes were found in the same levels as the bones of extinct animals. And he stated publicly in 1859 that human antiquity was very much older than the conventional 6,000-year chronicle in the Old Testament worked out by Archbishop Usher in the 17th century. In other words, here was a member of the scientific establishment, a man of culture, of deep taste, and of natural aptitude for the study of the past, whose son was born into an environment where items like coins, ancient jewelry, and even humble artifacts were a matter of daily conversation. John Evans was the classic Victorian. He wrote once that he believed in peace, prosperity, and papermaking. For all that, he was a very imaginative man and a marvelous father for a young son who was steeped in archaeology from his earliest years. Arthur Evans attended Oxford University, where he was restless. He wasn't a particularly good student. And after graduation, he indulged his passion for travel and intrigue. And he spent a great deal of time in the Balkans, which then as now were politically very volatile and were still part of the Austrian Empire. He indulged his passion for plotting and nighttime meetings, wore a cloak and a sinister hat, and thoroughly enjoyed himself until he was imprisoned by the Austrian government, who accused him of being a spy. The truth is that Arthur Evans was rather at a loss. He was volatile, he was passionate, and he really was at a loss as to what to do. The only continuity in his life was his interest in collecting prehistoric artifacts. He didn't dig, he just collected. And in 1884, partially, I think, to give him a job and something to do, he was appointed the keeper of Oxford's Ashmolean Museum. This strange institution, which it was in those days, had at its core a collection assembled by a man called Elias Ashmole, who was an Elizabethan merchant. It was, by the time that Evans came on the scene, a moribund institution, as only institutions can become moribund in universities. It was dusty, quiet, and neglected. To everyone's astonishment, Arthur Evans galvanized it and spent a great deal of time getting a new building, which he succeeded ultimately in doing. He also spent an enormous amount of time in the Mediterranean lands collecting artifacts for the museum. He realized the future of the museum lay in building a really important collection. He was away so much that it is said that his assistant keeper, and the word keeper is a beautifully British word, it really means curator. The assistant keeper would say to visitors who asked for Arthur Evans, "The keeper, sir, is somewhere in Bohemia," which was a tactful way of saying he hadn't a clue where Evans was. His duties for the university were very minimal. In those days, most university professors and faculty were assumed to have private means, and Evans travelled. He collected pottery, jewellery, and brooches, material which was ideal for him to find because he had a very unusual physical quality. He had microscopic eyesight, and he could peer at teeny engravings and intaglios and see in them things that the average scholar, even with a microscope, would not discern. And increasingly, he collected the teeny seals used by the Mycenaeans on mainland Greece. And many of these also came from Crete. He took to haunting the antiquities dealers' stalls in the Athens flea market. Time and time again, he would buy seals and say, "Where do they come from?" And the dealers would invariably say, "Crete." And in 1896, Arthur Evans travelled to Crete. And his purchases of seals in Heraklion, which is the capital of Crete, led him inevitably to the pottery-strewn hillside of Knossos, to the east of the capital. He arrived at a politically very, very volatile and difficult moment, because in 1897 the Cretans rebelled against their Turkish masters. This was a vicious insurrection. Genocide, slaughtering, a lot of bloodshed. And Evans, quite different from Heinrich Schliemann, threw himself into humanitarian aid. He raised money, he helped the villagers so much that he gained the gratitude of the local people in a way that almost defies understanding. He was on their side in a battle where they were definitely underdogs. And in the end, they won their independence from Turkey. And in 1899, I beg your pardon, Arthur Evans was able to succeed where Schliemann had failed. He was able to purchase the patchwork of land owned by different people upon which the Knossos site lay. Now, one of the great myths of archaeological history is that Arthur Evans actually discovered Knossos and was the first person to dig there. He wasn't. Local archaeologists had done some trenching in the site and found painted pottery. But given the political situation and so on, they had never followed up. So now, in 1900, Arthur Evans owned this hillside covered with potsherds and the foundations of building and encountered a major problem. He faced a complex site with numerous chambers, deep stratified deposits, and numerous potentially fragile artifacts. But he'd never dug a site in his life. He'd robbed a few graves, but that was about it. What in the name of good fortune do you do? Fortunately for science, he hired an experienced Scottish archaeologist named Duncan Mackenzie, who had worked on the island of Melos and other Mycenaean sites and had considerable experience. Once he'd hired an assistant, life was somewhat easier. But, like his contemporaries, and Evans had a deep pockets thanks to his family, he dug on a large scale. Now, this digging on a large scale is all very well. The advantage of it is it gives you an overall picture of a site. And Knossos, apart from its deep layers, is very much a horizontal site where there were different courtyards and buildings and so on. And crude, large-scale excavation did at least yield a plan of the palace. And to compensate for these rather crude methods, Evans at least kept relatively complete records by the standard of the day. He had another advantage, and here you can see the influence of changing times. He had a broad comparative knowledge of artifacts from other civilizations in the region. Egypt, the Balkans, Greece, Italy, Sicily, North Africa. This enabled him to assemble clues to date the civilization much more precisely than would have been possible even 10 years before. Almost immediately, the excavations yielded quantities and quantities of painted pottery and the rooms of a complex palace. And it was quite clear to Evans right from the beginning, and here his comparative knowledge came in, that this civilization was distinctively Cretan and quite different from that of the Mycenaeans. The architecture was different. The pottery was completely different. He announced in 1901 the discovery of an entirely new Cretan civilization, probably older than that of the Mycenaeans. And he named it the Minoan civilization, after the legendary Minos. And as he continued his digging, he became increasingly convinced that Minos had been a living figure in one form or the other. And then in 1925, he was lying in bed in the villa he had built as an excavation house, when suddenly the ground began to roll, and there was a loud noise, and church bells rang, and there was a groaning from the earth. And Evans irresistibly was reminded of a great bull heaving and rearing the earth, the bull, the Minotaur, in the depths of the palace. Because everywhere he found quantities and quantities of models, humble and elaborate, of bulls. Everywhere there were bulls, he said. And clearly, bull worship was part of the culture. The Knossos Palace was a maze of chambers and storerooms and courtyards, parts of it comprising several stories, centered around courtyards. Now, this excavation was a very different matter from that of Schliemann. Evans took very careful care to find as many small objects as possible, and he found the remains of brightly painted friezes on the palace walls. These he attempted to reconstruct. It gave him enormous satisfaction, too, that his father, then a very old man, was able to travel to Crete and see Knossos, and see what his son had wrought. And he wrote to him, sending him a check for £500, which was a lot of money in those days. "This is a notable day for Crete, which is as far as an unemotional British father would go." Also, in the first decade before World War I of the 20th century, Evans inherited an enormous sum of money from a relative, and he devoted a considerable portion of this foundation of money to a reconstruction of the palace. Not only did he study it intellectually and trace the pottery and artifacts of the Minoans over much of the Aegean to the Greek mainland and as far afield as the Nile, where he was able to use cross-dating to date the Minoan civilization to the second millennium BC, he was also able to reconstruct it. But this was highly controversial. Originally, the great staircase, for example, of the palace of Knossos had been supported with wooden columns, but they were rotted away. And now Evans had to confront how to reconstruct it. So he reconstructed it with reinforced concrete. The columns still stand today. But is this a faithful reconstruction? And the interesting thing now is, a century later, they're now having conservation problems with the reconstruction. Was his reconstruction accurate? He employed the best architects money could buy. He employed experienced people to rebuild it. He did a partial reconstruction, which was a good thing. He didn't completely rebuild parts of the palace. He rebuilt the great staircase, and he rebuilt certain chambers, reinforcing it against earthquakes, so that the visitor can get a sense both of the archaeology and of what it looked like. For example, he reconstructed the throne room, which has a stone throne in it, where elaborate ceremonies involving priestesses with fine friezes on the walls can be seen. And he reconstructed the friezes. Here, he took a few fragments and reconstructed scenes of goddesses and youths, of ceremonies, and of what appeared to be acrobats cavorting on the back of a bull, the famous bull-jumping scene. These reconstructions, in retrospect, three-quarters of a century later, seem somewhat romanticized and fanciful. But then Evans was, by inclination, a Victorian with a rather romantic view of the world. His view of the past was coloured with bright Mediterranean light, with blue skies, with the wind blowing through yellowing grass, and the palimpsest of rocks and clouds and deep blue seas, the wine-dark sea of Homer. Like Schliemann, Evans was convinced that there were roots in Homer which could be found among the Minoans. But more than that, he was interested in science. He used Minoan potsherds in Egyptian sites, excavated by Petries and others, to place the heyday of Knossos before 1450 BC, that is, earlier than the Mycenaeans. This was a case where a man didn't do an Austin Henry Layard and spend a couple of expeditions looking at the Assyrians. And he didn't, like John Lloyd Stevens, just go out and find Meyer and write a book and walk away. He spent more than 30 years of his later life working at Knossos. He was difficult, he was curmudgeonly, he was temperamental. Duncan Mackenzie eventually retired. He became an alcoholic. He got younger assistants. But always, in a way, I think Evans thought of himself as the ruler of Knossos. And his great monograph, and again here we have the theme of publication, his great monograph, The Palace of Minos at Knossos, published in many volumes between 1921 and 1935, is one of the classic monographs of 20th century archaeology. It describes every aspect of Minoan civilization. But In one respect, it fails. It's a classic work. No one who works at Knossos can survive without consulting it. But he failed in one thing. In the final analysis, Arthur Evans's real interest in the past was in seals and scripts. He fancied himself as an epigrapher. He had the minute eyesight and the mindset and the patience, which is rather a contradiction with the rest of his character, to puzzle over scripts. And, to his great pleasure, there were two scripts in the Palace of Minos and other Minoan sites, inscribed on clay tablets. Two different scripts, one he labeled Linear A, and the other one Linear B. He tried for a lifetime to decipher them and failed. Even today, they've only been incompletely deciphered. And his last book was a description of the script. It's somewhat of an elegiac book where he's taking farewell of his palace. Because I think Arthur Evans felt he owned this palace. Not physically, he eventually deeded it to the Greek government. But I think he felt it was his. And there's this curious identification that archaeologists have very often with their excavations, that the site becomes theirs. And they clasp the finds to their bosoms, and many of them never write it up. Evans published Knossos. And the vision and the powerful image of the Minoans he shared with the world has been a lasting and perhaps misleading legacy. As I said a moment ago, and I reiterate, Arthur Evans was captivated by the Mediterranean world of blue skies and sun-washed mountains and buildings. Knossos reminded him of the heroic world of Homer, of King Minos and the legendary Minotaur, half-human and half-bull. He became, in a way, a Minoan himself. He was entranced by the brightly colored wall paintings, by religious figurines of bare-breasted maidens holding snakes, the priestesses, and by the brilliant colors, the red columns and the brilliant colors of the architecture. Like all scientists, and this is a terribly fundamental point about any archaeology and any history of archaeology, and it applies above all to the early civilizations, is that all the discoverers of early civilizations, everyone who works on a civilization, be it on a minute aspect of Egyptian hieroglyphs, be it excavate an entire civilization like Layard did, or wanders among Maya cities, is someone who is looking at that monument, that civilization, that artifact, from the perspective of their own times. For instance, in the days of Schliemann and John Evans, a very dominant doctrine was the notion of human progress, that Victorian civilization was the finest, most sophisticated state of humankind in the world, and anything else was inferior. Doctrines of racism, ethnocentrism, and so on. Evans was a product of Victorian morality, of a somewhat romantic view of Mediterranean lands, which was a legacy of a classical education. Culture and classicism were deeply connected. And he was deeply, deeply in love, not only with the Mediterranean world, where he spent so much of his life traveling. He was a restless traveler. He was widowed very early in life and buried himself in his work and travel. He had a deep appreciation of the classical world. And he loved Crete, the friendly people, the volatile people, the bright sunshine. He was almost a Minoan himself. And he tended to idealize the Minoans as peaceful traders with a pastoral religion which invoked an earth mother, a mother goddess, a goddess of fertility. And his partial reconstruction of the Palace of Minos reflected his colorful vision with its bright columns and lively wall friezes reassembled from small fragments with considerable imagination. And if you want a brilliant description of Minoan civilization from this very romantic perspective, you should read a novel. It's still around, it's available in paperback, but it's a classic by a lady called Mary Renault. She wrote a novel around two things. One was the legend of Theseus and the Minotaur, where every 7 years the king of Knossos, Minos, sent for hostages, 7 girls and 7 boys. And Theseus of Athens became one of the hostages. And these were sacrificial victims for the Minotaur. With the help of Ariadne, the daughter of Minos, he killed the Minotaur and sailed away, going back to Athens, and his father, because a sail color was confused, threw himself off a cliff when he saw the boat with the black sail coming back. Mary Renault took this story and weaved into it a reconstruction of Minoan civilization and bull jumping, which historically has many holes in it. But if you want to feel a civilization live and people live and get some idea of the way people fought, then read it. It's called The King Must Die. The author's name, Renault, is spelt the same as the French motor car. But today, we know a great deal more about the Minoans. Their chronology is more precise, and we know for certain that they were far from the idealistic people memorialized by their discoverer. For example, a British archaeologist, Peter Warren, has found clear evidence that the Minoans sacrificed children in secret rituals. He found a shrine at Knossos where there was clear evidence of human sacrifice, bones with cut marks. And we also know from friezes found at Thera, the famous island north of Crete, which exploded somewhere around the 17th century BC, that they were as warlike and human as other civilizations of the day. It is very easy to romanticize the Minoans. They had this wonderful naturalistic pottery where, for example, on a pot you will see rich wild grasses teeming with seeds swaying in a summer wind. And you find patterns and you follow the patterns and they're utterly uniform and they lose you in the design of the pot. Wonderfully fluent. The friezes on the walls of the buried village at Akrotiri on Santorini, buried by the volcanic ash of this huge explosion, show young boys boxing, ships loaded with merchants and sailors, cities, dolphins, a colorful world. You can hardly blame people for thinking that the Minoans were very colorful, romantic, friendly people. But in fact, they were just as warlike and faction-ridden as their neighbors and the whole of the Eastern Mediterranean world. You see, we know now that the Minoans were part of a much larger world than the Aegean. They were in a world of traders, and they traded in olive oil and wine and timber. And their trade in their ships extended as far as Egypt and the ports of the Levant. The Minoans traded with the Egyptians and the Hittites, two of the competing powers who vied for mastery of the Eastern Mediterranean trade 3,500 years ago. These people were master traders, master diplomats, and didn't hesitate to use violence against one another. I like the Mycenaeans. This was a palace-based civilization which was teeming with factions and competition and constant change. And this constant change was in the end the seeds of its destruction, as apparently it was taken over by Mycenae. We're not quite sure. But Knossos has an image given us by an Englishman whose artistic taste was beyond question, who literally thought of Knossos as his. And he developed a romantic picture of this Bronze Age civilization which persists to this day. And we should also remember by this time the pace of archaeological discovery had picked up throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. And as Arthur Evans labored at Knossos Other archaeologists were working on Minoan neighbors. For example, they were investigating the complexities of Hittite civilization, Egypt's constant competitor, which we will examine in the next lecture.